So welcome everybody. If it's all right, I'm going to talk for a few minutes today. I've been thinking a little bit about some of the things in a couple of the talks by Joan that we played recently, and this has something to do with that. I guess it's about time in some way. I want to start by reading a koan that we read a while ago now, actually, several months ago. And one of the little commentaries on it, which will lead into something Joan was talking about. Yunyan asked Dawu, how does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use all those hands and eyes? Dawu answered, it's like feeling behind you for a pillow in the middle of the night. I understand. What do you understand? The whole body is hands and eyes. That's very well expressed, but it only says 80%. What would you say, older brother? All through the body are hands and eyes. And then there's a commentary by Yuan Wu, who compiled the Blue Cliff Record, which we also read at that koan seminar a while ago. Haven't you heard how Daoshan asked a monk, how is it when the Dharmakaya, the body of reality, is manifesting form in accordance with beings, like the moon reflected in the water? The monk said, like a donkey looking at a well. Shan said, you've said quite a lot, but you've only said 80% of it. The monk said, what do you say, teacher? Shan said, it's like the well looking at the donkey. This is the same meaning as the main case. So somehow the hands and eyes all through the body and the well looking at the donkey are related to one another. So Joan picks up on the donkey really wonderful thing that she wrote a long time ago, but that's part of now Acequias and Gates, which is the really wonderful collection of miscellaneous koans and lots of essays by her for working on the koans. And there's a reference to painting in here, which isn't terribly important, but I need to say what it is just so you get the example. The talk is about how she grew up in Los Angeles, and she spent most of her grown-up life in Northern California and went to a retrospective, I don't know where, of the paintings of the abstract expressionist Richard Diemenkorn. And she says that there's something about the light in those paintings that did something and, in a sense, gave her back the light of her childhood. So that's kind of where it's headed, and the light will come in from the one other quotation from this essay I'll read later. But this is more about the donkey for the moment. In another koan, so this is about working with koans and what working with koans can give us and hooks up to what we've just read. In another koan, someone asks about the relationship between form and emptiness, and someone else answers, it's like a donkey watching a well. And there I am sitting in the gallery looking at the paintings, just like that donkey. But then the first someone flips it over and says, it's like a well watching a donkey. And suddenly the paintings are gazing back. There's an interpermeation of consciousness, and the ground and the air we share become sentient and alive to us. So that reminds me a lot of another thing in a talk by Joan that we played recently and spent a lot of time talking about, and that was that stuff about mindfulness and concentration. And there she's talking about the way in which the way it's come down to us sometimes anyway, mindfulness practice is like this headlamp practice, and in some sense it's all about the eye and reinforces the eye, you know. So I'm doing mindfulness practice, so here I am intently looking at the flower, here I am looking at the statue, here I am smelling the pizza, you know. So whatever it is, it's a tremendous awareness on my own self-consciousness, and that's really what I'm paying for. Paying attention to, I'm sorry, and paying for, really. I'm paying for doing that, you know. And as against that, Joan suggests that it's possible to have a mindfulness practice where the well is looking at the donkey, where we're really aware of, as we pay attention to things, that they're paying attention to us, each in its own way. She cites a great story from a great master Ma, apparently leading a retreat somewhere, and asked the student, who looks kind of blissed and spacey, what were you doing? And the student says, oh, I was out talking to a rock. And maybe, I think it's Master Ma, I'm not positive. Says, well, what did the rock say to you? And the student looks really startled. And said, then the Master Ma says, well, that rock was nodding at you long before you spoke to it. There's certainly a feeling in all-day sits, retreats, if you have a practice, maybe if you don't have a practice, walking around, that we can get into a kind of space where there is this, you know, the rock is nodding to us, the trees are paying attention to us, everything in some way is registering the presence of everything else. And that's really a different kind of mindfulness, in which our mindfulness kind of falls into the interpermeating mindfulness of all the things around us, and we're really part of that. Emerson says someplace, he gives an extreme version of this, he says, philosophically considered, there's I and the abyss. You know, it's like me and everything else. And he says, from this point of view, even my own body is a little bit dark. So the body sort of gets thrown over to the side of the abyss. And there really is that sort of headlamp notion of consciousness and selfhood. And I think that's an extreme version. But speaking for myself, I certainly walk around the world that way a lot. And so when we talk about subject-object dualism, that's certainly one of the things that we mean, that there's consciousness categorizing, factoring, triaging objects and making sense out of them. And in that sense, there really is the sense of the knower and everything else is the known. And Joan talks about the headlamps. For me, it's really a binocular practice too, that I'm kind of there looking at all the things and scanning them. And the first thing I want to say about that before turning a corner, I want to go back to our notion that we repeat all the time, that our practice is really a both-and practice. We're not trying to radically simplify human existence by getting rid of a lot of what makes it complicated and wonderful. And that capacity of consciousness to categorize and manipulate and so on is fantastic. You know, the amount of stuff you can do with that, the amount of pleasure we get with it is remarkable. But you remember the Groucho Marx thing? He says, it's actually sort of a dirty joke. It's the show where whenever anybody came on a show, he would sort of interview him before they played the quiz game. And the guy says something about how he has like 15 kids. And Groucho says, what's that? And the guy says, oh, I really love my wife. And Groucho says, I really love my cigar, but I take it out of my mouth every once in a while. You know, just kind of gross. But so consciousness is like that. You know, I love my cigar, but I take it out of my mouth every once in a while. I mean, that sort of consciousness. It's really wonderful, but the practice as we practice it in some ways to allow us to bring in something else that will complement and maybe shift and rebalance our ordinary way of doing things, which is in some way the headlamp, the binoculars, and the cigar. So this is familiar ground for everybody. I want to try and give it a little bit of a twist that I come back to sometimes that I think is kind of maybe not unique to me, but you know, I have a penchant for it and kind of works for some people and doesn't for others. Anyway, I have really powerful memories, especially of retreats in New Mexico, especially during the long walks there, of walking down in the wash and really feeling that sense that everything is greeting me before I'm greeting it. And it's, you know, it's living things like the trees and their branches. It really also is the sand that feels my feet and, you know, is aware of me maybe before or as I'm aware of it, and the rocks and so on. And so the peculiar component for me is that a lot of those things are very importantly rhythmic and tactile. And this goes back to some of the body stuff that Connie and Robert have been bringing up the last couple of sits. There's a great thing that somebody noticed about, especially the poet Keats, but there are a lot of other writers as well, that if you look at the descriptions of and the descriptive terms in Keats, and especially the adjectives, a lot of them are words that must have arisen for him when he looked at something. So you have an adjective for how something looks, but that very, very often there's a kind of secondary component of the kinetic or the tactile. Let me do a Whitman example because it's one I know. So Whitman says, the play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag. And that wag is really strange, and it must have been visual, but in that moment he's really registering the moment of the tree. And I think actually because it's metaphorical, there's some sense of a particularly sort of intimate registering of it. Anyway, it's very common that, you know, when you walk around and you look at things, sometimes even when you hear things, that you can get either a kind of rhythmic sense of how that thing moves and a little bit of what it would feel like to move like it. Or you can get a sense really that you know what it feels like to feel that body, or that it's as if you're getting the texture of that body. The koans are full of what I would call sort of unspectacular synesthetic moments. So synesthesia, which I guess is a clinical condition, first of all, where you actually will sort of, you know, you'll hear a sound and you'll see a color or something like that, within 19th century French poetry is sort of spectacularly pyrotechnical. So Rimbaud talks about the systematic derangement of all the senses. So, you know, you really want to see colors and this and that. But the koans mention it all the time in this very quiet way. So they say, unless you can, it's so hard to say this, but unless you can see with your ear and hear with your eye, you're not yet intimate. And so there's a sense really that as you are with things in meditation or in a retreat, walking around, that very often, and I don't think we need to pay attention to this or be aware of it even, but very often one sense will sort of bring in another sense, and you're responding to and with the things around you and the creatures around you in a more intimate and rich, multifaceted way. Okay, so I want to suggest that, first of all, there's that possibility of identification, and so the borders between you and what you're looking at really, I don't want to say they begin to break down, but there's a sense in which they've already been crossed, and that's really important. I want to go someplace else with this in a second, but I will say that one of the great things that you can do in a sit is to let that kind of wash over you while you sit. So you come back from a walk, and some of those things that you've just seen are still there with you, and then sounds can come in. They can have that rhythmic quality, but there's a sense of sort of kind of short-term memory being with you on the cushion. And it's very common then for that to sort of slide back into long-term memory. So you get these odd sensations of how something moved a long time ago or what it felt like and so on. And those are all moments, I think, when the kind of narrative and the model making and the sort of binocular relation to the world is beginning to kind of fuzz out, or things are kind of fuzzing through it or fuzzing it up, and there's a sense of your immersion in that field. One of the things I think that can also happen, let's say when you're walking around, is as you begin to kind of reverberate or pick up on or do contrapuntal things with the things around you, that you really start to feel that you're just one thing in that field. And the other thing is still there, you know, I'm the consciousness, I'm Emerson saying it's the I in the abyss and so on. But that really falls away for a while, and you're really just one of the things that's there. And there's something kind of chastening about that, but it's also very soft, and then something can come up through that and out of it that's not chastening at all. So the other thing I want to try to talk about, are there any dance fans in the room? Or like any ballet fans? So this the subtext here is Balanchine, though I'll mention him just a little bit quickly. So one of the things I like about Balanchine's choreography is that, and I'll contrast him to Agnes de Mille, whom I don't like. In Agnes de Mille, who is always, I'm sure this is a misrepresentation, and you know, she choreographed the dance stuff for the musical Oklahoma and so on. It's very important. But anyway, in Agnes de Mille, very often the idea is kind of everybody's doing the same thing at the same time. Now we're all moving like this, and now we're all moving in some other way. And if you look at Balanchine, the dancers around the stage are doing really different things and will sort of pick up on and echo one another in different tempi, you know, different sort of rhythms of movement. And so there's this sense really of this kind of total dance of everything that in some way is orchestrated with and against everything else, but it isn't mere repetition. And so the interactions of various rhythms and the way in which, you know, one has a time relation to another, and then that gets played with in a funny way in terms of a kind of space relation. So something that's happening over here happens in another place in a slightly different rhythm that plays off the first rhythm. It's very, very beautiful, you know. One of the things that happens when we're in retreat is we're encouraged to not pay attention to the clock. And that's really, really hard to do. As soon as they say don't pay attention to the clock, you want to look at your watch every 5 minutes. But at some point, that will tend to fall away. And one of the things about clock time, this is a kind of a little bit of a forced analogy in part, but once you're on clock time, it's this mathematically regular, kind of absolute, very much kind of human-constructed conceptual grid of time. And once we're in clock time, we're really paying attention only to how things move in relation to that clock time. You know, so this took 10 minutes and this took an hour and so on. And so in some sense, everything is compared to some single standard. So the movement of the clock through minutes could be compared to how fast the car is moving, how fast we're running, how fast the sun is moving, and so on. If you let that fall away, then you start moving into a world that's kind of ghosted by Balanchine. What you begin to notice is that you notice the tempo of one thing moving against the tempo of something else moving. And you can start paying attention to these really variable but really wonderfully kind of interrelated senses of movement in the things around you. And then you're kind of playing into and off of those. And since people are imitative animals, in some sense, we're registering all that imaginatively in our own bodies. And I'm not sure why it's the case, but when I get in that mode of paying attention, at least for a while, it's great if you're in Arizona and in the desert. It makes it a little bit easier than if you're in Manhattan, I think. One of the things you begin to notice is that some of those rhythms are so slow, you know. So there's the saguaro doing what it does, and then there's the sand and the rocks. And it's very, very slow and almost not moving. And then there are things that don't appear to move. And I think one of the things that happens in that is that we get a sense, as we begin to pay attention to those things, of them moving in and through and against and with, and I'll come to this in a second, but as the stillness. There's a great moment toward the beginning of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, where Suzuki Roshi says, because everything is changing all the time, we experience our lives and the world as suffering. And what we don't see sometimes is that all of that is happening against this backdrop of this immense and utter stillness that's there. And so as we begin to see the motion inside that stillness or taking place against the kind of background of stillness, something else happens for us. So I think if you, I'm suggesting this actually as a practice, you know, if you begin to get into that thing where you're attentive to the rhythms around you and you're feeling them in some way, I think you'll start to notice more and more there's this stillness there. One of the ways it might be described is to say that the stillness is really holding everything, that it's the surround for everything, and I think that's true, and you can sort of see the tree branch moving against that stillness. The somewhat stranger sense is that the stillness is right inside that, and so it's a little bit like overtones in music. Ezra Pound, the poet, was talking about his book-length poem, The Cantos, but also about the world outside the poem, I think, talks about how there are kind of various rhythms going on in the poem, just as there are in the world, and that somehow underneath that, even if you don't hear it, there's what he calls this great bass, you know, which for me is like the didgeridoo of the world or something, you know, this is this kind of that's going on underneath that. And so I think it's possible to begin to get a sense, and I think this is very, very important, that the stuff that's moving also has stillness inside it, and that in some way the particular movements that it manifests are like overtones of that stillness, so that you can be in both at the same time. You don't have to be in one rather than the other. And so, almost done here, but I want to read one more thing by Joan at least, and then one other kind of slightly more abstract thing. So that stillness is very common. Not sure all of you know this, and have experienced some versions of it. It's also lit up. There's this sense that the light really is the same thing. So back to Diebenkorn in some way. And then there are the moments when everything drops away. This is also about Zhao Zhou's No, right? And then there are the moments when everything drops away, when that famous first koan isn't about the dog or Buddha nature or even the pilgrim with her question. Zhao Zhou's No isn't about anything at all, but is the light itself coming from everywhere and nowhere at once. It's really beautiful. And then here's a guy, Dale Wright, who's going to say it less beautifully, but I think it's important and relates to some things that I've talked with some people about. It turns out this guy, this is a book that John recommended to me. He teaches Buddhist thought and philosophy at Occidental in California. It's called Philosophical Meditations on Zen Buddhism. And I also like the fact that it turns out that he's a really good friend with the head of the East Asian Studies Department here, who's written a really good book on Linji. Anyway, all right. So this is about one of the early Chinese teachers, Wang Bo, and the notion of mind. So this will turn up as mind, but I think, or Buddha, but I think we could substitute kind of, you know, emptiness, shunyata, silence, stillness, that kind of radiating light. And this is about that as well. A significant proportion of Wang Bo's Dharma talk is concerned with correcting the conception of that which is experienced in enlightenment. This is the conception of mind or Buddha, still conceived dualistically as something to which the practitioner must come to be related. Turning away from ordinary things in the world, the source is sought as something extraordinary, but still something, one being among many, even if more mysterious, more powerful, and so on. So what are you doing? I'm looking for emptiness. I want to grasp it. You know, there's that. Taking one rhetorical pose after another, Wang Bo's text asserts that the source is not anything at all, but rather that within which all things are encountered. The ground, which for him is also the source, shunyata, all everything we've been talking about. The ground is encountered not in a separate relation, but in the midst of all other relations. Thus the practitioner is not to establish an independent relation to the ground in addition to and distinct from all other relations. Instead, practice is to cultivate the understanding and the awareness that every relation to things in the world is simultaneously a relation to the ground of all things, which has no existence independent of the worldly things through which it is manifest. This ungraspability of mind, Buddha, or emptiness is a constant theme of Wang Bo's sermons. Because it is only experienced within other experiences, a subtle form of awareness is cultivated to make possible a manifestation of this source, one which doesn't turn away from things completely, but at the same time is not compelled by things and thus obstructed. As the mind shifts in succession from one situation and object of awareness to another, the enlightened mind stays attuned to the one mind at the root of all things. Conceived in terms of the concept of emptiness, we are led to understand that all forms, all appearances, make their appearance in and through emptiness. Yet conversely, emptiness appears only in and through appearances. I mean, that's pretty abstract. I think it's pretty wonderful as well. But what I'm suggesting, again, just to go back to, I don't know if it's more concrete, but to go back to this notion of a kind of kinetics and rhythmic quality of what we're looking at, I want to suggest that it's in particular registrations and intimate connections to the things moving around us, that's at least one way in which the stillness can begin to be there for us. And of course, if you see it as overtones, it's a two-way street. So in the trade, there's discussion of rolling in, where one becomes aware of the one in some sense. And then there's rolling out, where, as Joan was saying, the kaniness of kani, the tathagatahood of kani, becomes really vivid. So if you can see that tree having the stillness within it, you can also see it as really being, you know, I'm the tree named Joe, and this is the way I move. And both those things can be there for you in the same moment. So thank you very much. We have a couple of minutes for tea and talk.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
Thanks, Karen.
You know, it's so interesting how you wove. It's like a weaving that you did. You know, from one stillness to consciousness to movement, back and forth. And you could have, the thought occurred to me that just one of the thoughts that you developed would really be useful to explore like for half an hour, you know, in depth, and you said so many things that it's going to take me a week to work on it all.
Thank you. I don't know if that's good or bad, but there it is. I think when you talk about the weave, that's really terrific to notice, because one of the things about our version of practice and the Koan tradition, and Jonah's mentioned this, is that the Koans themselves, if you take them up, you're always being tossed back and forth between the kind of stillness and motion, between the source and all its manifestations, between emptiness and form. And so that weaving really is our practice, you know. And the one of the great things in the Koans is there's all this stuff about, you know, sort of profound stillness, you know, seeing that thing. And then the Koans are kind of acerbic about it, and they say, when you get to that place, what you need is a way to turn around. So you need, you know, it's like you've gotten yourself to the end of this corridor and there's only stillness. Somehow you've got to manage to turn around and sort of head back, you know, running into the world that's cacophonous and full of motion. And the tradition really wants to give you that place to turn around. So the weaving is absolutely right, you know. So thank you.
And the weaving kind of goes with the rhythm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's right. That.
Yeah.
I mean, when you talked about Balanchine, it's just amazing.
Isn't that great stuff?
You know, you just see it in front of you. That's why to watch ballet, you really need to be on the top.
Yeah.
You know? It's nice to be in the front and you see all the nuances and the sweat coming off the brow. But if you see it on the top, then you see this amazing contrast from one part to the other, and at the same time it's the same at the same time, you know? And it's like that, but that's the way life is.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, it's a constant moving back and forth. Yeah. But Balanchine, just like, it's amazing how he can conceptualize this whole thing. And I still don't know how you write all of this down. You know, how do you write this down in a way that somebody else can interpret it?
Yeah.
The way you meant.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
One of the things that I loved about Balanchine too was that he often incorporated a mistake that had happened in practice in...
I didn't know that.
He could develop it.
Yeah. He would develop it and keep it there, and which was just delightful.
Thank you, I didn't know that.
Wabi-sabi.
Can I say something that has nothing to do with that? Just it has one connection, but have you seen On the Waterfront? The movie, and it was
not for a long time.
So there's this amazing scene where Brando is with Eva Marie Saint, and she drops the glove, and they're having this very intimate conversation, and he picks up the glove and starts putting it on his finger, and it's really complicated and really strange, you know, and very interwoven with all the things that they're feeling about one another. And that was apparently an accident that they kept in the movie. But anyway, never mind. That's not not the main point.
That's why there are no such things as accidents.
Right.
I have a little image from yesterday that kind of goes, is when we were doing lunch, and so part of the tradition is to collect an offering of food from each of us, and then Jen went and put it, there's the little off altar outside, not the main altar, and I thought, did she get that set up? You know, is there a little Buddha out here or something? And it was a rock, you know, a stone, where she put the thing. It's like, that's perfect.
Yeah.
I can set it up. You know, I like also that overtones idea, you know, how it's sort of, it's included, stillness is included in the activity and vice versa. There are the overtones sort of on each other.
Yeah.
That was a good way for me to really get a sense.
Thank you.
So that was a pretty,
It's also the need about when you run in the hallway.
Yeah.
You know, because this idea of you're going, wow, it's a stillness. But as long as you're aware of a stillness, and in a way, being aware of the stillness, when you turn around, it becomes totally full of the stuff. Mm-hmm. Since you're the stillness, you don't notice any separation between the stuff, but the stillness, it makes it so there's nobody else there too.
Yeah.
I'm sort of playing with that right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, it's great.
The idea of, you know, focusing on stillness is, and you see stuff arise there, is different from stuff arising independent of the stillness. But it's not like the stillness is out there. The stillness is, you know, that's who we are.
Yeah.
But then as long as we're aware of the stillness, stuff happening there, there's still a bit of a, the stuff is separate from us a bit.
There's distance in some way, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's that very difficult thing for me now is to be aware of being totally in it without losing the stillness.
Yeah. For me, I guess I think it doesn't bother me as much as it used to, and I feel like I've lost it. You know, it's like it didn't go too far. All right, I think we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.